and 71,150 others injured. Gaza officials also warned that the worsening humanitarian situation amid the heavy rains and flooding. An infant died due to exposure to extreme cold after hundreds of tents were flooded in several areas of Gaza. At least 12 people have died or are still missing after over a dozen war-damaged buildings collapsed across the territory as a result of the severe storm. Our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Musabbeh, joined us earlier with the latest updates on the dire humanitarian crisis across the war-ravaged territory.
Well, unfortunately, what the Palestinian people on the ground here are going through is the absolute and ultimate meaning of suffering and pain, because every single Palestinian civilian is trembling right now as a result of the fighting and is shivering cold. And as you know, we are talking about thousands of the makeshift tents that have been completely ruined and destroyed by the strong winds and the heavy rains that fell down on Gaza Strip over the past couple of hours. And as you know, a myriad of the semi-destroyed houses have fallen down over the heads of the Palestinian people. Dozens of the displacement camps have been overwhelmed and, let me say, completely ruined by the heavy rain as well. We are talking about an unprecedented situation for the Palestinian people. What's happening right now is a man-made disaster and catastrophe created and orchestrated by the Israeli regime. What's happening is the normal result of the ongoing measures and policies maintained by the Israeli regime against the Palestinian people. It has nothing to do with the Mother Nature here. It has everything to do with the Israeli regime, which kept preventing the Palestinian people from having any significant access to the life-saving materials, to the proper shelters, as the Israeli occupation forces have been shutting down all Gaza crossing and preventing the entry and the flow of those humanitarian supplies to the people. This is why the people are still suffering severely.
Well, Hamas has issued a serious warning about the grave humanitarian situation in Gaza as a new storm strikes thousands of displaced Palestinians living in dilapidated tents. The movement spokesperson Hazem Qasim said the situation of the displaced is worsening as their tents offer no protection from rain or cold. He noted that previous appeals about entry of suitable shelter materials to Gaza and the start of reconstruction have so far received no tangible response amid Israel's ban on aid delivery. The spokesperson slammed the failure by the international community to break Israel's Gaza blockade, emphasizing that it further deepens the territory's worsening humanitarian crisis. His warning came after the International Committee of the Red Cross Trust that residents of Gaza are in urgent need of immediate intervention to confront the worsening humanitarian conditions and lessen their impact on the displaced families. The International Criminal Court has rejected a legal challenge by Israel to block an investigation into its genocidal war against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. On Monday, ICC judges refused to overturn a lower court ruling that had allowed its prosecutor to investigate the regime's crimes during the war on Gaza. The decision clears the way for the court's investigation into the regime's crimes to go on. The investigation has already led to the issuance of arrest warrants for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Minister of Military Affairs Yoav Gallant. Both officials face allegations of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The ICC says Israeli crimes in Gaza since October 2023 fall within the scope of its ongoing Palestine investigation and that arrest warrants against the regime's officials remain valid. Civil defense crews in Gaza have begun search operations for the remains of civilians missing under the rubble of homes destroyed in the Israeli genocidal war. Rescue workers lift debris from destroyed homes as family members stand nearby attempting to identify the bodies. Civil defense crews are asking for international support to obtain better equipment and speed up recovery operations as many victims still remain under the rubble.
We started recovery work today in Gaza City, beginning with a family home. This multi-story building contains dozens of martyrs, more than 30 children, over 10 women, and elderly individuals. Victims remain under the rubble. Our capabilities are minimal. We are operating with just one small excavator, coordinated through the ICRC. What used to take hours with large machinery at the war's start may now take days for this site alone. With current resources, recovering old bodies across Gaza could take more than 3 years, which is a very long time and requires tremendous effort. We appeal to the international community and mediators to exert a real effort for Palestinian victims, equal to that made for Israeli bodies. The scene is horrific, with unidentified skeletal remains requiring lab analysis. We face constant threats from unexploded ordnance in the rubble and risk of infection from handling decomposed bodies. The work environment is extremely hazardous.
With the civil defense team's help, we recovered some bodies. We hope to recover all our martyrs within the next few days. We contacted the civil defense, and they confirmed our case is a priority when equipment is available. We thank them for their help in retrieving the bodies. But the wound has reopened today. It feels like they died all over again.
Well, Iran has strongly condemned the continuation of the Israeli genocide in Gaza through the regime's incessant bombardments and the blockade of humanitarian aid entry into the war-torn territory. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said the international community, topped by the United Nations, is responsible for taking immediate and effective measures to stop Israel's crimes and hold the perpetrators to account. He categorically condemned Israel's blatant violations of international humanitarian law and the regime's war crimes and crimes against humanity, stressing the need to end its impunity. Baghaei said the U.S. and other countries providing Israel with arms and political support are complicit in the regime's crimes in the occupied Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. He added that despite its ceasefire agreements with Gaza and Lebanon, Israel continues to commit savage crimes against both nations due to Washington's unbridled support and inaction of ceasefire guarantors. Baghaei called for serious measures to confront Israel's threats to regional and international peace and security. A cross-party and independent delegation of city councillors from Northern Ireland has traveled to London to meet with the families of jailed Palestine Action hunger strikers in a show of solidarity. The development came on a day that saw several protests in support of pro-Palestine activists currently held in British prisons. Our correspondent has spoken to some of those protesters, and here's what they had to say.
Members of Derry City Strabane District Council, and our council does have a history of solidarity and support for the Palestinian cause, and that was extended to support the hunger strikers and express solidarity. We listened to the families, and what they were saying is very, very similar to what Irish people faced at the same enemy, the British imperialism, with the hunger strikes in 80 and 81, and not just that very system that demonizes and criminalizes anybody who dares, you know, oppose it.
It's no surprise to us that the British state, with all its Zionist interests, with all its colonial interests, with all the violence that it spreads around the world, continues to ignore us. The lives of the hunger strikers, just like the lives of the Palestinian people, are worth nothing compared to the profit of companies like Elbit Systems. So we make our own justice. That's why we're here today with our comrades from Ireland. That's why we continue to fight on the streets with the people to do things in our own way.
While on the ground, Israeli forces and settlers press ahead with their months-long violent aggression against Palestinian towns and refugee camps across the occupied West Bank, causing casualties and property damage. In their latest attack, the regime's forces raided the town of Tuqa'a, southeast of Bethlehem, opening indiscriminate fire and critically injuring a Palestinian teenager in the chest. The 15-year-old later succumbed to his injuries. Separately, a young Palestinian man was shot with live ammunition in both legs during an Israeli raid in the town of Arram, north of the occupied city of Al-Quds. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers attacked the Burqa village east of Ramallah, setting a large number of olive trees on fire. Since the Gaza genocide started, there have been a sharp uptick in attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. According to Palestinian officials, Israeli forces and settlers have committed more than 2,100 attacks against Palestinian civilians and their properties in November alone. We earlier spoke with our West Bank correspondent Aqa Hamad to get an update on the latest Israeli violations against Palestinians in the occupied territory.
Late Ammar Sabah was standing in a bakery where he used to work, and the Israeli forces suddenly raided the village, started shooting live ammunition and tear gas canisters, and while doing so, the injury happened. The live bullet settled inside Ammar's chest, and later he was announced killed in Beit Lahem's General Hospital. Well, the other situation, which is the injury that happened near the separation wall in the village of Arram to the north of occupied Al-Quds, according to the PRCS, the young man has already arrived to Ramallah's medical complex after being received by the Palestinian ambulance from the Israeli forces. Also in the village of Jayus to the south of occupied Qalqilia in the north of occupied West Bank, the Israeli forces have rammed over and has demolished agricultural facilities inside the village and have bulldozed trees in a massacre that is continuing. It's continuing in a very ugly phase, which is the uprooting and the cutting of the Palestinian trees. Some of these trees are more than 1,000 years old.
Well, French protesters have gathered in the capital of Paris to denounce austerity measures and a growing war economy. They argue that public funds are diverted from healthcare and education to militarization and foreign interventions. Demonstrators also criticize France's recent military actions abroad and the billions allocated to the defense budget. Students, in particular, voice concern over universities' partnership with arms companies, saying it makes them complicit in genocide. Our correspondent has talked to some of the participants, and here's what they said.
This gathering follows other demonstrations and rallies that we have organized against militarization and war, because, as you must know, in France and throughout the European Union, the economy is doing poorly. But it is being redirected toward war and toward imperialist aggression budgets, whether it is support for Israel, the war in Ukraine, or interventions in Africa. France, just last week, carried out a military intervention in Benin. That is just one example among others. So we have a system that is completely running out of steam and is trying to survive through a war economy and by increasing arms sales, profits, arms dealers, and so on. And of course, young people in particular, but also the country more generally, do not want to sacrifice healthcare budgets, education budgets, and more broadly their standard of living to a war policy and to sending young people to serve as cannon fodder.
So this is a rally against austerity and the war budget. We are here to denounce the social security budget, but also to denounce the war budget, which I believe is close to 400 billion euros for imperialist war, for colonial wars in Palestine and everywhere else in the world. I think that when you are a student, you realize this more than other people do. For example, our universities are directly complicit in these genocides. If we take the case of Palestine, I am a student at Sorbonne University, and Sorbonne University has direct partnerships with arms companies.
In other news, Iran has called for the next Secretary General of the United Nations to be selected through a transparent process, voicing its readiness to engage in meaningful discussions throughout this process. Iran's permanent UN Ambassador Amir Saeed Aravani made the comment while addressing a Security Council session held to discuss the qualities of the future UN chief. He said a candidate who has deliberately failed to uphold the UN Charter or to condemn unlawful military attacks against peaceful nuclear facilities, despite responsibilities of the organ he leads, could not be trusted as a faithful guardian of the UN Charter. Aravani added that such a person will not be able to fulfill his duties independently, impartially, and without political bias or fear of powerful states, as required under the Charter. Iran's ambassador also declared Tehran's willingness to work with the next Secretary General to advance peace, justice, and the purposes and principles of the UN Charter. Well, our final story this hour, leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, known as ECOWAS, have agreed to forge a proactive front to put an end to the spread of military coup in their region. They took the decision during their latest meeting, the Nigerian capital, at the weekend. Danjuma Abdullahi reports from Abuja.
ECOWAS leaders have wrapped up their 68th meeting in Abuja, outlining what they called far-reaching resolutions on regional security. They agreed to forge a united front to fight the spread of military coups, terrorism, and other forms of insecurity. The decision followed a series of successful military takeovers in the Sahel, including a coup in Guinea-Bissau last month. Earlier in December, there was an attempted coup in the Republic of Benin. It was thwarted within hours after the government deployed Nigerian jets and ground troops. Experts say the swift response demonstrated regional solidarity, but they also warn that ECOWAS countries must remain vigilant amid Western attempts to foment instability through further coups. Experts say several decades after the establishment of ECOWAS, the regional economic bloc has been unable to achieve full economic and political integration. They believe that ECOWAS must detach itself from its colonial past and avoid reliance on external aid. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
Well, thank you very much for this hour's headlines. More updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Goodbye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Throughout history, mosques have always been serene havens for Muslim worshippers. Magnificent buildings have developed significantly during the years, and their unique and one-of-a-kind architecture has fascinated people throughout history. Iran is adorned with glorious mosques that invite you to a divine feast of colors, each reflecting the genius of their architect and the amount of skill and proficiency that goes into each and every detail. In Tehran, mosques are found on nearly every street corner, making it easy for Muslims to attend the daily prayers. The Imam Khomeini Mosque, located right inside the Tehran Bazaar, is one of the oldest structures in the city, dating back to the early 18th century. People in different parts of the bazaar have easy access to the courtyard, and so many retreat to this calm shelter for their daily prayers. Inside the mosque, one is spellbound by the amount of color that has gone into the intricate tiles decorating all the arches and niches. The elaborate geometric designs that adorn the walls and ceilings are also something to reflect on.
The architect architecture of mosques in the country vary from one region to another, depending on culture, heritage, and the resources available. Now, these buildings are different from each other in terms of color, the various symbolic patterns, and the different styles of tile work. But there are a few common elements that most of these mosques share with each other.
One of the common features of every mosque is the mihrab, a niche in the wall that indicates the direction towards which Muslims pray. Although the mihrab varies in size, they all have intricate arabesque and calligraphic designs made by joining numerous cut glazed tiles.
Beautiful pools has always been an inseparable part of the mosque because water is known for its purity, brightness, and transparency. Water has always been associated with the divine and also known as a purifying element.
The history of tile work in Iran goes back to the prehistoric period, but it was in the Islamic era that this unique art flourished and became the most important decorative feature of religious buildings. For Muslims, these floral patterns in distinctive colors, especially turquoise, deep blues, and rich reds, represent the infinite and convey a sense of spirituality.
Dignified, magnificent, and impressive. The architecture of the mosques in Tehran reflect creativity and beauty. Every tiny little detail creating an atmosphere of holiness and spirituality.
Apart from the floral designs, exceptional calligraphy works are also displayed on these tiles. Calligraphy is closely linked to geometry because the proportions of the letters are all governed by mathematics. Most mosques have some type of service inscription, which might be a verse from the Quran, lines of poetry, or names and dates. Sometimes a single word, such as Allah or Muhammad, are repeated and arranged into patterns over the entire surface of the walls. The two other common features in most mosques are the minarets and domes. Minarets are tall towers that not only provide a visual focal point, but are also used for the call to prayer. Domes are also one of the signature forms in Islamic architecture, symbolically representing the vault of heaven.
One of the well-known mosques in Tehran's Chariati Street is Husseiniyeh Ershad, which was built half a century ago. This mosque is well-known for all the political and historical events that happened here during the course of the years.
Our way of living changes as the years go by. But some things in life stay the same. People come, people go, but they remain standing. The architecture of the mosques in Iran is part of eternity, echoing the glorious image of God in its every detail and corner. Hoda Lezgi for Iran.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough. But sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone from heaven.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, lofty levels of humanity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Shred with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously, so lofty levels of humanity. So this, in a sense, is sort of goal setting. We know as Muslims that we can really aspire to, and we can reach very high levels of humanity if we purify ourselves, if we have good akhlaq, if we are pious. And at the same time, we are also taught that if we just become let's say, ruled by our base instincts, we'll actually sink below the level of the animals. So obviously the high level, the highest levels of humanity that we can attain to actually go beyond, above the angels. And then obviously the very low levels below the animals. So what can we do? Who are these people who achieve these lofty levels of humanity? So for sure, we know that obviously all are infallibles. Are at the highest levels. The prophets are at the highest levels. Now we know that our martyrs achieve very high levels. But we also have amongst us many people who are purifying themselves, who are very good hearted and who can also achieve very high levels. So I just want to comment on, for example, one of the martyrs from Holy Defense, Ibrahim Hadi, especially as I've said that this is something that we can always look to the martyrs to see what did they do, what was so special that made them scale these heights of humanity, basically. So people would say, so friends of Ibrahim Hadi's, for example, would say that they'd never seen anyone like him. But what they also then added, some of his friends said that Ibrahim Hadi had grown up in an area that had produced other people like Ibrahim Hadi. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being Shred with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about these lofty levels of humanity that martyrs can achieve and that everyone else, all of us, can also aspire to achieving. And I've just mentioned that some people commented, for example, on Ibrahim Hadi, one of the martyrs of the Holy Defense, and this we'd be able to say similar things about all the other martyrs. So he, for example, had grown up in an area that produced other people like him. People in that area were concerned with halal and haram. People in that area where he grew up as a child, they were concerned about respect and knowledge. Many of these youth also played in the local sports teams there, and many of them got martyred. So who were these people? What was this area? And indeed, what were these times? And as we're talking about times, we're talking about the sort of a time of the Holy Defense. What about now? Can we have this same thing now in our local area? So think about it for yourself. Are people in your area, would you say that people are thinking about halal and haram? Are people aware of this? Is this a really important topic? Being respectful, being knowledgeable, so being able to have conversations about this. being very engaged in the community, contributing, participating, helping the local community, and then to such an extent that, for example, if another war were to happen, is everyone in the same space? Is everyone ready to basically be martyred for Islam, for their country, for the Islamic Revolution, for, and obviously for Islam, whatever country you're in? So this is something. So, and if we answer to ourselves, well, no, I'm not living in an area like that. Or if you say, no one I know is like that, my friends aren't like that, we don't even talk about things like that. Well, you know, if you're aware of that, you have knowledge, so you be then the person that starts with to start talking about these things. And bit by bit, maybe, you can sort of draw other people into that conversation. And if you're aware that these sorts of things are happening, people are really involved in local community, and you're not yourself, then go out there, sort of go to the Majlis, go to the Rosa, involve yourself in your community, and keep talking to people. It's really important to sort of also just nurture the community spirit, especially nowadays. So pray that this is just a reminder for all of us. And that was it for today, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of AZ here on Ambush Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Was the week that was. Beyond the headlines, we dissect the stories that shaped the past 7 days from the heart of region to the global stage. Of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Hello, dear listeners. Welcome to our political chat show, That Was the Week That Was. We look at global politics and issues of the day, and I'm your host, Leila Garcia. With me here in the studio is veteran journalist and political commentator, Meron de Akhshand. Please stay tuned. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much indeed.
Today's discussion is about two U.S. fighter jets entering Venezuelan airspace and flying over critical infrastructure amid heightened tensions in the region. The pair of U.S. Navy F-18 fighter jets flew over the Gulf of Venezuela, a body of water bounded by Venezuela and only about 115 miles at its widest point, and spent about 40 minutes inside Venezuelan airspace starting at around noon on Tuesday, 9 December 2025. A U.S. defense official, though, insisted that the jets stayed in international airspace during the flight. The United States has already deployed an estimated 15,000 to 16,000 troops near Venezuelan waters to pressure President Nicolas Maduro's government, and has previously sent a B-52 Stratofortress and B-1 Lancer bombers to the region, which flew up to and along the coast of Venezuela. Also, President Donald Trump bragged about seizing Venezuela's largest oil tanker during a White House press conference on Wednesday, December 10. Venezuela is one of the largest suppliers of oil to China, which has been the destination of between 55% and 90% of the country's oil exports. This week's seizure marks the first time the Trump administration has moved to interfere with the country's oil distribution amid the hostile pressure campaign. A Bloomberg report called the move a serious escalation. Speaking to reporters in the White House, Donald Trump said it's the largest one ever seized, and now other things are happening. Okay, let's bring in veteran journalist and political commentator Mehran Derakhshan.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, what more can you tell us about two fighter jets entering Venezuelan airspace?
Yes, this was an incident on Tuesday, 9th of December. Two U.S. fighter jets circled the Gulf of Venezuela for about 40 minutes. And the two aircraft flew just north of Maracaibo, one of Venezuela's most populous cities. According to American officials, the planes conducted a routine training flight similar to previous exercises, and the jets flew between two major regions for Venezuela's energy sector, including Lake Maracaibo, the cradle of reserves containing several billion barrels of crude oil. The waters are also regularly crossed by oil tankers and load and unload crude oil at refineries in the states of Zulia and Falcon,
right,
that are key to the domestic fuel market in Venezuela and the nation's hydrocarbon sector.
Mm-hmm.
The city of Maracaibo in Zulia state is also the home to one of the main military air bases in western Venezuela.
Right. Trump administration has seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. The operation was carried out by U.S. Coast Guard Force officials revealed on Wednesday, 10 December. Why did Trump order the seizure of the oil tanker?
Yes, that's right. As you said, U.S. forces have seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela, and this is meant to put pressure on President Nicolas Maduro's government.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
And Pam Bondi, the U.S. Attorney General, posted footage about the seizure of the oil tanker on X. And this was a 45-second video which showed U.S. military forces landing on the oil tanker from a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
In an accompanying statement, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi said the FBI, Homeland Security Investigations, and U.S. Coast Guard, with support from the Pentagon, had executed a seizure warrant for a crude oil tanker used to transport sanctioned oil from Venezuela.
Right.
Venezuelan government, however, says that the seizure constitutes a blatant theft and an act of international piracy. The Venezuelan government added, under these circumstances, the true reasons for the prolonged aggression against Venezuela have finally been revealed. It has always been about Venezuela's natural resources,
right,
in
true.
Particular Venezuela's oil,
mm-hmm.
its energy sector, and the resources that belong to the Venezuelan people. But interestingly enough, the U.S. President Donald Trump said, he was asked what they're going to do with the oil tanker.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump said, I assume we're going to keep the oil. So that's very interesting.
All
Trump
right.
saying he's going to keep the oil,
mm-hmm.
which many people would interpret that as meaning that one of the key reasons why the United States is putting so much pressure on Venezuela for the past 4 months is precisely because of the oil.
I see.
It wants to effectively take over control of Venezuela's oil.
All right.
Now, Attorney General Pam Bondi later expanded on Trump's statement that he's going to keep the oil. She said, we had executed a seizure warrant for a crude oil tanker, and this tanker was used to transport sanctioned Venezuelan oil. But despite this, many international observers are saying that this operation of taking over an oil tanker, it really is theft in broad daylight. So it's a complete violation of international laws, although, as Attorney General said, a U.S. court of law has ordered the seizure of oil tanker, but the oil belongs to Venezuela and not the United States. So I'm just wondering, Donald Trump's statement that I assume we're going to keep the oil, that's what Trump said.
Yeah.
Is that legal? Certainly not. It's not legal.
Yeah. People have been killed in a series of strikes against boats suspected of transporting drugs in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific. Are these strikes legal?
That's a good question. The U.S. military, according to the latest figures we have, has launched 22 strikes on alleged drug smuggling boats in both the Caribbean Sea and the Eastern Pacific Ocean, resulting in at least 87 deaths since early September.
Right.
And these are all classified as extrajudicial killings. And the Trump administration is targeting drug smugglers, allegedly, and the Pentagon has yet to release concrete evidence to the public that the vessels they're targeting with these airstrikes are actually carrying narcotics or drugs, and they actually do pose a threat to the United States. So far, we haven't seen anything from Pentagon to show any evidence that these boats are actually carrying drugs and narcotics.
That's true.
The latest we have is that Congress is now demanding or threatening to withhold funds from the Pentagon unless it sees unedited videos of these airstrikes.
Mm-hmm.
One particular airstrike has very much caught the attention of lawmakers in Congress. That was one of the very first on 2nd of September. Actually, we had an airstrike on a boat which totally destroyed the boat, but two people actually survived that first attack. They were clinging on to the wreckage of the boat. But then we had a second airstrike which killed those two people.
Yeah.
And some lawmakers in Congress have said this is a war crime because effectively the boat was totally destroyed and demolished by the first strike.
Right.
There was no need to carry out the second strike. So the political website Politico has interviewed Donald Trump, and Politico asked Trump whether he would consider using force against targets in other Latin American countries, not just Venezuela, in other regional countries as well. For example, Mexico and Colombia.
Right.
And President Trump said, sure, I would. He said that if those countries, Mexico and Colombia, which are very active in drug trade, that he would consider airstrikes against those as well. So that's the latest we have.
I see. Donald Trump has warned that land attacks are coming soon to Venezuela, but has not offered any details on location. Tell us more about that.
Yes, this is the interview with the political website Politico. In this interview, Trump said that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's days are numbered, and he declined to comment on whether the U.S. could send troops underground in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Asked whether the U.S. could send in troops underground, Trump said, I don't want to comment on that. Pressed during the interview with Politico on how far he would go to take Nicolas Maduro out of office, Trump said, I don't want to go into the details of that. They asked him, do you want to see him out? Trump replied, his days are numbered.
Asked again whether
he would rule out a U.S. ground invasion of Venezuela, Trump said, I don't want to either rule it in or rule it out. So he left that sort of ambiguous. Tensions between the United States and Venezuela have soared in recent months, and the Trump administration has conducted various strikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean Sea and Eastern Pacific Ocean.
Yeah.
And last month, President Trump suggested that the U.S. could very soon target Venezuelan drug traffickers on land inside Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
That was last month.
Yeah.
So that's the latest we have on that.
I see. Lawmakers are now demanding to get unedited video from the strikes, or else they will limit Pentagon's funding. Tell us more about that.
Yes, Congress is aiming to withhold part of U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's travel budget until the Pentagon hands over video footage of the airstrikes on alleged drug smuggling boats near Venezuela. This provision was tucked into the compromised version of the National Defense Authorization Act, an annual defense policy bill that has passed every year, and this has been so for the past six decades. Lawmakers unveiled the bill, which authorizes nearly $901 billion in defense spending.
Wow.
The bill is expected to pass both the House and the Senate with bipartisan support. According to the latest we have, the lawmakers are threatening to withhold a quarter of Pete Hegseth's travel funds until the House and the Senate Armed Services Committees receive unedited videos of boat strikes conducted in the area of responsibility of the United States Southern Command. The provision also requires the Pentagon to turn over overdue reports, including on lessons learned from the Ukraine war, before the funds are released to the Pentagon. The requirement to release the video footage follows the revelation that two survivors of an initial boat strike on 2nd of September in the Caribbean Sea were killed in a follow-up strike on the same boat. Two sources familiar with the video of the airstrike said the two survivors were waving their hands and they were clinging on to the wreckage of the boat before they were killed in the second airstrike. Now, last Tuesday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Dan Kane, and the Secretary of State Marco Rubio briefed congressional leaders and the top intelligence committee members of the House and the Senate. Military officials briefed a small number of lawmakers on the incident on 2nd of September, and there are questions about the legality of that second strike on the boat, which killed those two people, two survivors clinging on to the wreckage.
Right.
Some members of Congress were shown a video of the 2nd of September operation in last week's briefing, but the video has not been released publicly. And we know that the U.S. military have struck more than 20 alleged drug boats since early September, killing at least 87 people. President Trump initially said he would support release of the video footage about the second strike on that boat, which killed the two survivors. But later on, he seemed to backtrack on that promise.
Right.
Later on, Trump said, "I don't know what they have. Whatever they have, we'll certainly release it, no problem." That's initially he said, "Whatever the Pentagon has, we'll release it, no problem." But on Monday, later on, Trump walked back on that promise. He said he was comfortable with whatever Pete Hegseth wants to do. So he said he was comfortable.
Right.
And Pete Hegseth actually said that he may not release the video of the second strike on the boat. He cited ongoing operations in the region. He said this is confidential. So Pete Hegseth suggested that he may not actually release that video.
Right. Listening to the Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran, English Radio. This program entitled, That Was the Week That Was. President Maduro has said the real reason for Trump's fixation on Venezuela is oil. What do you think about that?
Yes, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro says the real motive behind the massive U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean Sea is all about oil. Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world, even larger than Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. State Department denies this. The U.S. State Department insists that the airstrikes on boats that have killed more than 80 people, this is part of a campaign against drug trafficking. But what has now become clear, certainly in the past few weeks, is that Donald Trump is absolutely determined on regime change in Venezuela.
That's true.
I mean, the size of the military forces in the Caribbean Sea suggests very much regime change. And we can say that Trump has proved happy to reach an understanding with authoritarian leaders elsewhere, for example. And we can also say that these airstrikes on various boats and vessels in the Caribbean Sea, these are unlikely to have much impact on the flow of drugs in the United States. In fact, most experts say that the majority of those drugs flow into the United States by land through the vast southern border with Mexico. So critics are saying that these airstrikes on boats in the Caribbean Sea, allegedly drug boats, they won't have much effect in sort of restricting the supply of drugs into the United States because most of the drugs are coming through land through the border with Mexico.
That's right.
Now, what about Colombia? Well, Colombia's president, Gustavo Petro, who is himself is involved in a bitter feud with Donald Trump, he has described the last campaign in the last 3 or 4 months against Caracas as a negotiation about oil. So again, Colombia's president, a next door neighbor to Venezuela, he thinks that much of what is going on in the Caribbean Sea and all this pressure on Nicolas Maduro is a sort of a negotiation about oil. Colombian President Gustavo Petro said Trump is not thinking about democratizing Venezuela, much less about drug trafficking. He's simply interested in the oil.
Right. Russian President Vladimir Putin has expressed his solidarity with the Venezuelan people. Tell us more about that.
Yes. The Kremlin said in a statement that Vladimir Putin spoke with Nicolas Maduro by phone and reaffirmed his support to the Venezuelan leader. President Putin said Maduro's policy of protecting national interests and sovereignty in the face of growing external pressure. He said Russia backs Venezuela. And this phone call actually happened after U.S. military forces seized that oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela. So the phone conversation took place after the seizure of the oil tanker by the U.S. military. President Maduro has insisted the real purpose of U.S. military operations in the Caribbean Sea near Venezuela is really to do with Venezuela's oil.
Right.
As far as the oil tanker is concerned, the Venezuelan government has said the seizure of the oil tanker by the U.S. military constitutes a blatant theft and an act of international piracy. The Venezuelan government has added President Putin told President Maduro that direct communication between Moscow and Caracas would remain permanently open and Russia would continue to support Venezuela in its struggle to assert its sovereignty, international law, and peace throughout Latin America.
Right.
Now, I can say that just like his predecessor, Hugo Chavez, Nicolas Maduro has forged a close relationship with Russia. And another thing I can mention is that back in 2018, there was a brief period when Russia dispatched a pair of Tu Tupolev 160 bombers to an airport just outside Venezuela's capital, Caracas. And this was back in 2018. So the Russians have given military support to Venezuela in the past as well.
Right. To sum up very briefly then, the seizure of the oil tanker near Venezuela's coastline is literally theft in broad daylight, and Trump's claim that he wants to keep the oil shows that a major motivation for attacking is to take control of Venezuela's oil. Thank you, Mr. Rashana, for your insightful analysis.
Thanks for inviting me.
For more on these and other critical issues, be sure to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en. And that brings us to the end of today's program. Join us again next time for another edition of That Was the Week That Was. Take care and goodbye.
يا إلهي لك الحمد الله يا إلهي Morning to you all. Greetings from Tehran. You are listening to Iran Radio. I am Asma, your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's program with The Keys of Life. The program aims to introduce an Islamic lifestyle based on the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Jabudi Amoli. After that, we have Economic Divide. If you're interested in economic or business issues, then this program is for you. The program covers the biggest business and economic stories of the day. And our final program this hour is The Gate of Knowledge. The program explains and illustrates the profound moral, ethical, spiritual, and social teachings in Nahjul Balagha.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa sallallahu ala Muhammadin wa ali baytihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin. Brothers, sisters, listeners. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to the program Mafatih al-Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Abdullah al-Musawi. We are discussing the qualities of a leader, a person who places himself in a position where people need his help and they seek his help, and obviously he's in charge of their affairs. Number of things we mentioned previously. Today, one of the things that this leader need to have is he should be able to overlook